The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 14th of December, after which I'll hand it off to Raymond Moore and Brian White for hour number two. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got some great guests on the lineup card for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in former NBA center, the author of a new book of his artwork called Growing Up in Words and Images. Joe Barry Carroll will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to former NHL goaltender Clint Malarchuk, who will discuss his trials and tribulations in life and the inspiring story that he tells in his new book, A Matter of Inches, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on this Sunday evening. And as always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240, most cleverly. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more, so stop by, give us a look. Then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest was the number one pick in the 1980 NBA draft coming out of Purdue, taken by the Golden State Warriors. He spent 10 years in the NBA with the Warriors, the Houston Rockets, the New Jersey Nets, the Denver Nuggets, and the Phoenix Suns. His new book is titled Growing Up in Words and Images. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight Joe Barry Carroll. Joe Barry, good evening.
Good evening to you.
Pleasure to have you with us.
Now, Thank you for inviting me.
You were born, Joe Barry, in Pine Bluffs, Arkansas?
Yeah, I was, in 1958.
Right, and you moved to Colorado for high school. Now, who were your early influences there? Your favorite teams, ball players?
I'm usually just for the home team. So in Denver, there was Ralph Simpson, not Sampson.
Right, Ralph Simpson. Yeah, I remember him.
And David Thompson and those guys, and mostly Ralph, especially because he would come over to our community and hang out like he just, you know, like he grew up there or something.
So those were the ABA guys.
Yeah, I'm that old. Can you?
Like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But we moved to Denver. I think I was 13, so I actually did junior high school in Denver as well. My mother moved up there for seeking a better way of life, as many people from the South did during that time, and continue to do, I suppose.
Sure. Now you went to Purdue.
I did.
Why'd you pick Purdue?
Well, they picked me. I was a late bloomer, so
okay.
I was kind of like just getting in under the wire. I think they were in Denver recruiting someone else who maybe didn't – well, I know they didn't come because I was the only one from Denver to go there. And they offered me a scholarship, and they had a big, you know – big team and big academic program because I wanted to get myself a diploma while I was in college, and I thought it was a nice little mix. But, I mean, it's funny. I didn't even really know what the Big Ten was at that time. I was just impressed with the facilities.
Sure, okay. Now, you had a nice career in college, definitely. Junior year, you went to the NIT finals.
We did, right there in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Final Four appearance in your senior year.
Yeah, we kind of surprised some people because the year had been kind of a little up and down. I mean, I'd had some, you know, good personal statistics, but it was a bit of a challenge for the team at times. But we got it going just at the right time and ended up at Market Square Arena for the Final Four.
Definitely. Now, from there, it was on to the big time, to the NBA, number one draft pick by the Golden State Warriors. Now, the rookie season, I had read now that some people perceived you as indifferent, your critics. might have been harsh.
Well, I mean, it's the business that we were in. I mean, as a professional player, I mean, that's what people do. They come to the games or they watch from a distance and they, you know, have opinions one way or the other. I probably could have helped that situation along a little bit if I was more active with the media, but I was over there thinking I was just kind of minding my own business, and that is not the place you want to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, I also read, because it might have been they traded Robert Parrish for the draft pick that they traded was used to take Kevin McHale to Boston. So that
right.
might have, and I guess the fans were a little perturbed at that.
No, I never got that they were perturbed. I think looking back, some 30 years later or whatever the number is, it looks like the deal looks one way. But at the time, it was not that big of a deal. It was
okay.
just a transaction made. I mean, you got to remember, back in 1980, the NBA was not what it is today. So it wasn't like Wilt Chamberlain trade or something like that. It was,
yeah.
it was a significant trade, but it was not the trade that some of the, pundits would try to make it be. It didn't, I mean, that's just in hindsight because of Boston's success with Larry Bird.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
You made out fine.
It's fun to talk about, I suppose. So if we're just talking about it for fun, then let's go at it. But it's not. I don't think it was as deep as some people would try to make it later. It's just something fun to talk about because it looks like a stroke of genius, given that the Warriors were, so poorly managed at the time, early years for me. Later on, we, got a little momentum, but it just seems like that was just their history.
Well, you still came off. You average 18.9 points that season, 9.3 rebounds, which is nothing to cough at.
Well, I've always had good personal numbers. I think the challenge sometimes for really good players, because I had some years that I averaged 25 points a game in the NBA over probably a 100-game season, which is a big deal. But sometimes I don't know that I ever got to that place to where I could, lift the entire team up. And I think that's what really, makes the difference between stars and superstars, is when you're able to, make your whole team better. And you try, but some people have that gift and some don't.
Not many do. Not many do,
yeah.
Joe Barry.
Yeah, yeah,
there's
yeah.
one guy that did that you played with, and that's Bernard King.
Well, actually, Bernard was a tremendous personal talent.
Yeah.
Because, he showed out. He really, he was serious. He was a mercenary on that floor in terms of his performance. But I'm not sure if I would go so far as to say that he elevated the team, but he was a very good teammate. But in terms of making other players, because for me, I had to get out of his way, because a lot of his scoring was drives to the basket, so that meant mm-hmm. clearing the big man out. And it wasn't until I matured a little bit to where I kind of stayed in there and had him make a decision, But he was always a really good teammate and a good friend while we were playing, so I got no complaints about him.
Two other guys that you crossed paths with a few times later on that ball club, World Be Free and Purvis Short.
Yeah. Purvis and I played a long time together. World was kind of at the end of his career. He was bouncing around a little bit. He wasn't really doing a whole lot when we played together.
Okay.
Yeah, but Purvis, he was just a couple of years ahead of me, I believe. Always a great shooter and offensive player.
Good scorer, yeah.
And we're both from the South, so we have that kind of relationship thing.
Good bond, yeah.
He from Mississippi.
Yeah, okay. Now, in 84, you went to play in Milan. What made you decide to go to Italy, Joe Barry?
I didn't want to sit out that year, and the Warriors were trying to. They felt that they had me because I wasn't that popular necessarily at that time, and nobody else. I was kind of like their ugly girlfriend. They didn't want me, but they didn't want anybody else to have me. So they kind of declared that they were going to match anybody's offer, but they really were not, because the offer they had for me was really inferior. So I didn't want to sit out that year. So I went to Europe. I had an offer to play over there and made as much money as I would with the Warriors with the numbers they were offering me. And when I came back, it was a nice, reasonable deal available for me. So I re-entered the NBA.
You did. You had good success in Milan.
I did. It was good. You don't want to sit out, especially as a big man. It's hard to duplicate the intensity of the games and even in like exercising. You're never going to exercise as hard as somebody's going to push you
right
when you're practicing and playing games three or four times a week. So it was really I didn't know it at the time, but it was really a wise decision.
Probably was. Yeah, we're speaking with Joe Barry Carroll tonight. Yeah, 85-86, you're back with the Warriors. George Karl comes along as your coach. You're averaging over 20 a game. Sleepy Floyd, guys like that on the team. Also, yeah. Future Hall of Famer Chris Mullin.
Yeah. Chris was my rookie. Just really, nobody could have known he was going to be as great as he was at that time because he just seemed he was. But he came in and we just had a good time. He had a little bit of a hiccup there because he had to go take care of some personal matters for a little while. But
right.
During the time that we were rolling, it was really fun because he has really great hands. He doesn't really run fast or jump high, but when he gets there, he handles the business because we never discussed catching the ball, but he could catch because I was a good passer and he caught all the passes in the little small space. All you needed was enough room to pass the ball through and he would get it.
He's one guy that really he worked hard to get where he got.
Well, we all do, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I think the NBA sometimes, especially if you're far away from home, I think you work out a little bit more until you kind of work your way into, you know, creating a life for yourself on the West Coast.
Yeah. Now 87, you're an All-Star, Joe Barry. You go to the All-Star
game. They should have picked me earlier, though. I had some numbers that should have had me there before, but when I went in whatever year that was, we were winning. And that really makes a difference.
Yeah.
If you're winning on a winning team, you can have low numbers and make it. But if you're losing, you know, the whole world hates you.
Yeah. That's when you're ugly. Yeah.
Yeah, you just get ugly, man. Yeah. Nothing works out. You know, food, eating ice cream isn't good.
Yeah. So 87, you go to the playoffs too against the Jazz.
Yeah, we had that was fun. We were down two games and came back and won three in a row, which back then they used to play, I don't know if they still do, I know they don't do the five games anymore, but back then the first round was five games, and that was a real big deal. We did something that hadn't been done in many years, but like, you know, all records, they're broken eventually.
Right. Well, throughout your career as a Warrior, top 10 career franchise leader in defensive rebounds, your third. Offensive rebounds, fourth. Points per game, eighth. Total points, ninth. And steals, ninth. That's a remarkable stat. Scored at least 1,000 points in each of your seasons as a Warrior. And you left Golden State as the franchise leader in blocks at 837.
You never know all of that to hear it, which...
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder myself, well, like, damn, I mean, when I hear these numbers, because I've... Since I've been doing the book since February with the book, people will share these numbers with me. And at the time, I don't know that I was as aware of them, but it doesn't match up with some of the criticism that players get sometimes when you look, you dig, you know, scratch below the surface and find out like, wow, they got numbers. And I had numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on. Tell me some
more. Yeah, and you say to yourself, yeah, man, I was pretty good.
Shout it loud, man.
Yeah, then you think 837 blocks. It's currently the second most behind Mr. Foyle, who had 1,090 from 97 to 2007. So yeah, that's pretty good.
I think so. You know, you do the best you can, man. I mean, it's a lot of serendipity involved with players' career. I mean, certainly you have to be good, and you do have some impact on your success, but anybody who's ever played the game or people who become intimate with it, you know, and not just casual observers, you do discover that some of that is timing and, you know, just good luck, you know, sometimes. But you got to be good. But after you're good, you need a little bit of time and to play with the right group of players. I mean, because when I was with the Warriors, after I was traded away, there was a group of guys that came later that they were just missing a center. When I was playing there, they were just missing some other part or whatever, you know. So it's always sometimes all those parts coming together.
All the pieces to the puzzle, Joe Barry.
Yeah,
that's
I think so.
Yeah.
At least that's the story I'm going with because it favors me a little better.
So then we move on with Joe Barry Carroll to the Houston Rockets in 87-88, last full season with the Lakers. The production begins to go down a little bit. You go with Sleepy Floyd to the Rockets. Ralph Sampson and Steve Harris move on, and then you play for Bill Fitch.
I did. Long, hard story. That was
yeah.
Yeah.
So then you help the Rockets to at least you go to the playoffs. You lose to the Mavericks in the first round. How is it playing with Hakeem? The two big men must have been tough coming to some common ground there.
No, not really. I mean, he's just a phenomenal player. I mean, we were both kind of – when I came to Houston, I was coming off a good year at the Warriors. I had just been injured that fall, and we lost early on, and I think they wanted to go a different direction, as is famously said, in any place when they want to, you know, pack your bags. But I'm a true center, and he certainly is, and I think there's just, you know – it didn't work. I'm not sure how well it worked with he and Ralph. I mean, they did have some success, but it's just, it's a challenge. If you've got one of the centers is a real power forward as opposed to a true center, it might work, but it's a little difficult. But that wasn't really, I didn't have the numbers there. And I think, again, they wanted, you know, it's timing. I think a lot of it is just timing. That's all. Yeah. And then I end up in New Jersey for that long year.
Yeah,
that was
a bad Nets team, Joe Barry. That was a bad Nets team.
I mean, that's the history, also the history of that area, you know. It's that way, because sometimes it's helpful if you look at the historical, from a historical perspective, and you understand all of that stuff. But at the time, it was just hard. You just go out, no matter how hard you try, it just seems like you know, with a buzzard luck, you can't kill anything and won't anything die for you.
And Willis Reed was the coach, folks, if you don't remember. And they fired Willis, and they brought back Bill Fitch to coach that Nets team. And it didn't matter if they brought Red Auer back in there. It wasn't going to work.
No, I think some coaches benefit from having a Larry Bird. I think Bill, you know, he did really well with when he was somewhere. I mean, he's got a long history, so obviously he did something somewhere. But I didn't have any luck with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you went on to Denver, and you had some luck there. Fat Lever, Alex English, good ball players. But you ended your career with the Phoenix Suns, and that was a pretty good send-off. That was a good Phoenix Suns ball club under Cotton Fitzsimmons.
It was good to play with some good – I mean, it's good at towards the end. The difficulty for you – for me, I always knew I'd play as long as I had a guaranteed contract. I just never wanted to try out for a team. And so I was at that point to where I was going to need a champion, because some players will play 14, 15, 20 years even, but they have a different personality than I have. They have a different type of game. I've always been a finesse player, so we have to have certain situations for ourselves. We don't create as much as things are brought to us as finesse players. And at the end, it was just time. I mean, I had done over 10 years because I was in Europe for that year, and then nearly 10 years in the NBA, and it was time. And I was okay with it because I was, you know, I was weary at that time as well, because there seemed to always be kind of a double standard for me.
Right.
And I just didn't – I wasn't feeling that anymore. I just wanted to kind of go somewhere and sit down and be quiet for a little while.
Yeah. Well, you went out, you averaged 17.7 points per game, 7.7 boards. Not too shabby for an NBA career.
Not at all.
I mean,
guys want those numbers. So, you know, I'm grateful. It was not the perfect career, but then I doubt that anyone has a perfect career, because even the guys who really excel, sometimes they stay around too long. Sometimes they want something that they can't have later, because being in the NBA is such a special experience. It's just hard to duplicate it anywhere else. So you're always wanting a little bit more and a little bit more.
Yeah. But
when that time came around, it was just time to go, and you just have to give it up. You think about it, because you think you can play in your mind, but your body just doesn't have it anymore.
The flesh is willing.
It is, man.
Yeah, it does. That's it. But Joe Barry's got a new book out. He's done some great things in his life. Aside from being the first overall pick in the NBA draft, he developed a model to invest and manage his NBA earnings. Imagine that these days. He established a nonprofit foundation at the age of 26, founded a wealth advisory firm. Obviously, with his new book, he taught himself to paint. At the outset of this book, it's called Growing Up in Words and Images. Joe Barry says, much of what I share within my historical narrative may sound harsh, because some of it was. However, I encourage the reader to hold into view that the best parts of my character and moral fiber flow from my family, my people, and my early life experiences in that place called Pine Bluff, where he grew up. He uses a unique Southern style to write intimately about the trials and rewards of growing up, seemingly to not be enough of any one particular thing to be the right thing. Yet he was a son who never outgrew the notion that they will save the day for their families and especially their mothers. Every time I witnessed my mother's defeat and difficulty as another dream died, I resolved to make it all better one day, he says. Talk a little bit about that, Joe Barry.
Ooh, I want that book. I like the way that sounds, man.
You like that? Yeah.
I began journaling some time ago, because you write things down because maybe you're the only one that understands them, and maybe you'll have deeper understanding as time goes by. And the painting was a few years ago. And I just, at some point, I felt confident that it was, you know, worthwhile to take out into the world and share it. And I did, because people talk all the time. You know, everybody says they have a book in them, but I think the real challenge is, do you have something that is worthwhile to other people? And because a lot of my experiences are, you know, they're common to everybody. I mean, if you read long enough, you'll see something. I don't know where you're born or what your personal background is, Bill, but I think that you'll see yourself in there someplace.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of a nice communion of sorts, just on humanity.
Okay. Now, yeah. This is a coffee table book, too.
It
right,
is.
Joe
it's
Barry?
A big old
yeah,
book. It's a, I'm a big man. I need
right.
a big book. It's 12. It's a foot. It's 12 inches by 12 inches.
Uh-huh.
And it's very colorful because I'm country. You know, people in the country, they like colors. They like a lot of bright colors and stuff.
Now you paired the painting with narrative.
Yes.
That's great. Now, you experimented with colorizing old family photographs. How'd you do that? Talk a little bit about that.
I fiddled around with painting and drawing just to kind of have an appreciation for some of the art that I collect, because I've collected art for probably, I don't know, 30 years or so.
What kind of art did you collect, Joe Barry?
King's a great art collector, too. See, a lot of this stuff that we're talking about me, it's a lot of the players do it as well. Other guys, Grant Hill, a lot of these guys are art collectors. But I started doodling, like, you know, you draw and you colorized pictures and stuff, just to get a feeling, a deeper appreciation for some of the artists that I wanted to buy, because I was moving into an area where I wanted to buy some more expensive pieces, and I wanted to kind of have a deeper appreciation for it. And then I discovered I liked what I was seeing, and I never ended up buying those pieces because I hung my own pieces now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you paint, what I enjoyed reading is that you added mixed materials, paint, fabric, newspaper, and even coffee grounds. Talk about using coffee grounds.
Now, to be honest, sometimes artists will use what's convenient.
Okay.
It's like you may be in your studio and you don't really want to make the run to the art store or go out and get supplies, so you start looking around and test yourself. But I like to the grinds themselves in this particular painting. There's one painting that does have some grinds in it. I like texture. A lot of the pieces, even though they're not even mixed material, because some of them are just acrylic on board, it still has a lot of dimension and texture to it. And it's just, you know, all of us have some type of personal appetite, and mine is toward bright colors, textures, dimension, and movement.
Yeah. Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. Sure it does.
All right.
Now, where can people get this book, and how they go about getting it?
JoeBarryCarroll.com. That's all I got to remember is my name. And you go there, and the wonderful thing about this is a fundraiser, because all of the proceeds goes to my nonprofits. And this nonprofit this year is the Georgia Innocence Project. which actually was the Innocence Project in general, I think, was has a big history in the New York area, I think, with Barry Sheck or somebody up there. And down here in Georgia, we have an Innocence Project as well that exonerates innocent men and women, poor, mostly poor, and people of color from prison by using DNA.
Ah, okay.
So the money goes to that. It's a nonprofit. It's a fundraiser.
All right.
I said all that to say that it's a fundraiser.
Now, you're involved, I was reading in your bio, Joe Barry, you're involved in a lot of nonprofits. You're even involved in National Public Radio.
I am. I love the work they do there. And a lot of these organizations are, you know, their cause is great, but they lack resources, financial resources in particular. And sometimes if I could contribute some money and make something wonderful happen, then I do. Like, for instance, with the George Innocence Project, if you ever sit in that courtroom and hear that judge exonerate a man who's been in prison for 18 years for something he didn't do, you'll be writing them checks forever, because it makes your heart heavy and excited at the same time to know that you might be able to make a difference in someone's life who can't help themselves.
You do. Well, you certainly do, Joe Barry. Now, can people get the book on Amazon, too, or just through JoeBarryCarroll.com?
Yeah, you can get it. It's certainly there at Amazon.com. It's on Amazon, and then you can go to my website, and it can be fulfilled as well. Wherever they get it, the proceeds are still going to go to the nonprofit and the Innocence Project in particular in this case. The reason I say JoeBarryCarroll.com so often is that I think that's always so easy for people to remember, because once they get there, they'll see the book, and it'll be easy to get for them.
Any chance you're going to sign that book for them, Joe Barry?
Actually, for the holidays, my editor, Tara Coit, she created a fundraiser around that if you do it now, you get a signed book. I was just over there signing books when we announced this last week.
Outstanding.
So it is signed. They can get it. And I got as many as they want. Tell them, come one, come all.
There we
buy
go, folks.
Buy often. Give them as gifts.
Yeah, what an outstanding holiday gift that would make, folks. A sign.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to see this book. I've paged through. You can page through it at JoeBarryCarroll.com. It really is a beautiful book, and it would make an outstanding holiday gift, folks. Take a look.
I think so. It'll be fun. I mean, there's enough sports in there for you to remember that I am an athlete, but I think beyond the athletics, there's also a lot of human interest. I got an opinion on everything, and I tried to be thoughtful and balanced in my opinion, so you'll find that there, too. There's something for everybody in it.
Well, you're the man, Joe Barry. It's been an honor talking about your career, your work, your book. We thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk with us. The book is called Growing Up in Words and Images. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
Joe Barry Carroll, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk about some trying times and some triumphs with our man in the crease, Clint Malarchuk. Stay with us, folks.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you can find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this holiday season Sunday evening. Well, my next guest was a goaltender in the National Hockey League for 11 years for the Quebec Nordiques, the Washington Capitals, and the Buffalo Sabres. His new book is titled A Matter of Inches, How I Survived the Crease and Beyond. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Clint Malarchuk. Clint, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, Clint. I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, I don't want to spoil the end of the book, but I did live.
Yeah, I gather that. I almost didn't tonight, though, I'll tell you that. I want to ask you, Clint, growing up in Canada there, who were your favorites? Who'd you root for?
Oh, man. You know, I was a big Glenn Hall fan, but I was a little young for his era. I caught the tail end of his career, but I got to know him as a person and a goalie coach and that, and he's just such a great guy. But I you guys are going to kill me. I was kind of a Flyers fan. I love Bernie Perron.
Yeah, I had Bernie on the show. He's a real great guy.
And the only problem with that, I guess, is I can't say the Islanders because – I remember my second NHL game. The first game I played in Buffalo, I was with Quebec, and I had a great game, so they played me on the island the next night, and we lost 10-7.
Oh, man.
That was bossy, had a hat trick, and, you know, it was back in the 80s when the game was, you know, back and forth, and, you know, the only consolation was that Billy Smith let in 7, so there you go.
Yeah, he had a bad night, Billy. I wonder what happened.
he was you know, his seasons weren't always off the charts. It was the playoffs.
No, yeah, that's when Billy was on board. That's when the money was on the line. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a clutch goalie. You know, when the chips were down, that's when he came to play.
That's what got him up to Toronto. Yeah. Now, you were up against it at home, though, Clint, from what your book brings out. You had some problems with your dad. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, growing up, you know, it wasn't the ideal home. But, you know, I try not to make a big deal about that. I mean, I talk about it in my book. But, you know, there's so many people that come from tough upbringings, and in my case, an alcoholic dad that was, he'd go MIA for a while, and then he'd show up, and, you know, when he was sober, he was a great guy, and, but it caused a lot of anxiety for me, and, I think I became, really depressed, and a lot of times really anxious, and it started young in my life, so... You know, later on, it overtook me, but, it started off early in my life.
Your problems with anxiety. Yeah, I can see where that would stem from. Now, when you got into the pros, you started off with the Nordiques. You really had some great teammates up there. Peter Stastny, some classic names, Mario Marwa, and your buddy Dale Hunter. Yeah, you had one guy that I remember from the Rangers when I was a kid, Moose DuPont. He was a classic. Do you remember Moose?
Well, yeah, because he was a big name with the Broad Street Bullies.
Yeah, he was. That's right.
And you know, now he's a veteran player. He was a big presence with the Nordiques, and he was a real comical guy. You know, and he was a throwback. You know, to the earlier era. So it was kind of fun to be around him. You know, he's a guy that was very easygoing, comical. He was our captain for a while there, and he was also, you know, these guys, he'd be puffing on a cigarette doing a fitness test in training camp.
Yeah, he was. I remember. I think he was drafted by the Rangers back in 1969.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a character. We're talking to Clint Malarchuk tonight on Sports Talk 1240. From there, you went to Washington. How'd you get to Washington from Quebec?
Well, I remember that was it was at the draft table in the summer, and I was going to play a baseball game in a tournament, and I get there, and the guy said, you were traded. You and Dale Hunter were traded to Washington. And I was like, what? I thought they were kidding me, you know, trying to get me going. And sure enough, I was. It was before the cell phones and all that. So, you know, I turned the radio on. I called home. And, yeah, I had the call of Capitals GM, David Poile, and they had picked me up with Dale Hunter. And, you know, they had traded a first-round draft pick, and there was quite a few players crossing there. But that ended up being Joe Sakic. So I used to tell everybody, yeah, I was traded for Joe Sakic. I didn't tell them it was the most player.
Not bad, right? Yeah.
Yeah, not bad. That opened some eyes. You're like, what?
Yeah. Now, you had some pretty good teammates on the Caps, too. You had Mike Gartner, Scott Stevens,
yeah.
Rod Langway.
Rod Langway, Kevin Hatcher. We had a pretty good team. You know, Gustafson was there, and you know, we had one of the Courtneau brothers. We had a pretty good team there, just like in Quebec. You know, with the Stafflys and Goulet and them. So I was fortunate to play for some good teams. The problem was we had some good season with the playoffs. You know, and we talk about how some players are you know, average in the season and great in the playoffs, like the Islanders, Billy Smith we talked about.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah, same thing. Now it's on to Buffalo. And before we get to the incident, you had some great players up there, too. Yeah, a guy we had on the Islanders, Turgeon.
Yeah, and another one, LaFontaine.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, we had a good team, and McGillney was a kid coming over. He defected from
from
Russia. Yeah, and you know, guy
Andrychuk.
You know, that Andrychuk. Yeah, we had some really good players there too. I mean, we had Dougie Bodger on D, and Mike Ramsey was an Olympian in the 80 Olympic, the U.S. Olympic team, and so. Yeah, it was a pretty strong. I think we finished second overall one year there, second or third.
So, well, what's it like going to Buffalo though? That must be in playing in Buffalo in the winter.
Yeah, you know what? I just got back there. I literally got back in the house here. I just flew back from Buffalo. I was up there doing a book.
Oh yeah, I saw you were signing your book up in Buffalo and Amherst. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, I'll tell you one thing, that town, it might snow and it might get, you know, pretty good winters and all that, but boy, they are the greatest people. There was lineups at the, you know, and I haven't played there in years, but there was 2-3 hour lineups at these bookstores and people turned out and, you know, it's a blue collar town that loves their sports, loves their athletes. And, you know, it's one of those towns, you might not be the superstar on the team, you know, even if you are the superstar on the team, you might not get the love that the Grinders get. You know, they like that blue collar attitude in players too.
Well, I'm glad they turned out for you up there, Clint. That's marvelous.
Well, they were awesome. I mean, my wife flying to Buffalo the first time she'd ever been there, and she said, what's Buffalo like? I said, well, you know, it's a city, you know, like any other city. A little bit of winter and that, but I said, the people are so friendly. And she found out real quick. She said to me, you're not kidding.
Nice. Well, let's talk about the night of March 22nd, 1989 now. The people can read all about it in that chapter in the book, and Clint describes it really well. We don't have that much time to talk about it tonight, but in a nutshell, set the stage for us, Clint.
Well, you know, it was just a typical hockey game, and it was the first period, and, you know, you see this play a zillion times. You know, puck's in the corner, gets passed across the top of the crease, and I slid around across in a butterfly. I was down on my knees, and my defenseman, a guy was going hard at the net, Steve Tuttle with St. Louis, and my defenseman kind of held him up, and this guy flipped backwards, and his skates came up, and he caught me in the neck and severed my jugular vein. And, you know, after that, it was rush. I was, you know, I absolutely thought I was dying. I mean, the amount of blood that was squirting and pouring out of me, that and that set a tone for a lot of other things later that I talk about in the book about, you know, I wasn't diagnosed with PTSD at the time, but being predisposed to mental illness like depression and anxiety and OCD, within a couple of years, probably within the first year, man, I couldn't leave the house. I was totally depressed and then anxious and OCD. And you know, later on I got diagnosed that, you know, no one ever thought that accident, you know, triggered that. Well, what we know now, that trauma can do a lot of things, you know, and, you know, that's one thing. You know, I'm a big supporter of the military. We have 22 suicides a day of veterans coming back from there. They survived the war and come back here and end their lives. And yeah. That's that PTSD, you know, and that's what it'll do to you. So I'm getting some feedback from some of these guys in emails that have read my book, and, you know, God bless them, but the book is helping them. And for me, that is such an honor, and it's invaluable for me, like, to know that it's helping people. And, you know, when I wrote the book as well, you know, I didn't know how it'd be perceived, because, you know, the media describes the book as very honest and very raw. And, you know, I wasn't sure what it would be perceived like, because the people that know the struggles and have them themselves, they love it because it seems to help them. But other people might not perceive it the same way, but it's been great. It's helped a lot of people, and feedback has just been tremendous.
That's excellent, Clint. Yeah, that it helps these soldiers with their post-traumatic stress. And what people may not realize with what happened to Clint and the injury to his neck and the blood on the ice, that the fans in the stands, what was it, Clint, that two fans in the stands actually had heart attacks?
Yeah, you know, it was funny. At the book signing this past weekend, there was a guy who came up to me, and he said he was a paramedic at the game, just as a civilian, you know, just and he was running around because people were passing out and having chest pains and, like you said, two heart attacks. You know, it just goes to show you. I mean, it's described as the worst sports industry injury. But, you know, I don't know if it's the worst, but it's certainly the most graphic and gruesome. And it's still on YouTube. And, you know, if you Google me and you know, they don't show it much on TV interviews that I do. They'll show a clip of it, but not the whole thing, because it's pretty gross.
Pretty graphic, and people, yeah.
If you're not prepared for it or you can't handle blood, you don't want to watch it.
No. I mean, I don't know why someone would Google it in the first place. It's reading about it is one thing, and for people who buy the book, it's a necessary part to read about what Clint's trials and tribulations. But yeah, to Google it and to watch it, I don't know why somebody would do that. But yeah, you're right. To get through that, talk about your recovery period, Clint, and what it took to get through that and getting back into the uniform and back into the rink.
Well, you know, I think that's why I'm you know, the big turnout in Buffalo, because I came back really quick. You know, I came back, I was back playing in 10 days, and that town of Buffalo really admired that, to get back that quick. And it kind of adopted me. I became kind of a cult hero. And I didn't know, there was no counseling back then. And, you know, I didn't think of it. No one really brought it up. And, you know, I came back and I kind of rode that emotion and the support of the city. And, it's funny. I made it through the rest of the season and playoffs okay. But that summer, it was July, and I was still going, man, I'm so weak. And it was because of the loss of blood that happened in March. And,
yeah.
You know, it would take a long time, but, you know, I didn't understand that it would, throw me over the top with all this mental stuff, like the depression, anxiety, and that. And that was where the story really starts to take off. And, I struggled for a long time. I got some medication and did really good for a while. But then when the accident happened to Richard Zednik, he got his jugular vein cut in the same city. In Buffalo, he was playing for Florida. You know what? I kind of spiraled down again, and then I think the depression and everything, and I actually shot myself and survived that gunshot wound to the head, and that's when I went for extensive treatment and therapy, and was diagnosed with PTSD, and that they figured all these years of trauma was just sitting in there. And it took me down. That took that many years for it to kind of explode in me. And fortunately, I survived that and went through the treatment and everything. And that's a story in itself. And that's actually what kind of got me to, I survived, these near-death experiences. And I was like, why me? Why did I survive? Why was I spared, even with the gunshot, the bullet in the head? My God, why was it? And that's kind of what inspired me to write the book and talk about it in depth.
Yeah. Now, are you doing any counseling?
People ask me if writing the book was therapeutic, and it was not, because it was actually one of the hardest things I ever had to do was write that book. But.
Uh-huh.
I'd had so much counseling and therapy before that, and the book was difficult to write. And I take medication today. I'm on top of my mental and emotional state all the time. I'm making sure I'm in the good place. Really, the book, now that it is written and it's published, it's out there. I'm kind of on cloud nine a little bit, because I'm just getting so much feedback from people. Thanking me for doing, and they don't feel alone, and they know there's help out there now, and that to me is been so gratifying.
Yeah. Now do you fear relapse at all, Clint?
Well, I a healthy fear, for sure.
Yeah.
I do have a healthy fear of it, and that's a good thing. It's like with, I self-medicated with alcohol for a long time to handle the anxiety and depression. And that's something that a lot of people relate to as well, because a lot of medications you take, they don't work. You have to try different ones to get the right chemistry going. And it's really hard. So, just like alcoholism, I have to worry about relapse there too, but it's a healthy fear.
Right.
I go to meetings. I do 12-step program. I'm up to that. And just like I am with my mental illness, I have to make sure I'm really in tune with my emotions and where my head is at.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like with every other addiction, with every other problem, you have to stay on top of it.
Yeah, you sure do. You know, I think it's something I'll have to be on top of the rest of my life. I know.
Exactly.
I will.
It's a daily struggle.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now
some days I do great. A lot of days it's just, I cruise and no problem. But, I still have some tough times, but I know what to do now. So recognizing it is key, having that recognition and getting on top of it.
Definitely. And It seems like you're on your way.
I'm doing well. Thank
yeah.
you.
And one thing I wanted to talk to you about, Clint, that I thought was very interesting in the book is the fact that you're an equine dentist right now.
Yeah. I'm an equine dentist and chiropractor, and I've actually been up in the Long Island area and worked on some horses out there. I think it was Calvin Klein's ex-wife had some horses.
Okay.
Barnes & Noble, the people that own Barnes & Noble, I was there doing their horses. I was in Martha Stewart's neighborhood in Westchester, but I know I was on the island doing some, and that was pretty cool. Some fancy barns there.
Wow. Okay. Now, I couldn't begin to ask you how you go about it. I can only imagine. All I think about is Mr. Ed when I watch Mr. Ed.
Eddie's teeth and on his back. It's hard to get them to stay still on the table, you know, when you adjust them.
Yeah, I can imagine. God bless you. Yeah, that you're back and you're doing something you enjoy, and that you have the book and people recognize that you went through the struggle and you're an example for other people.
Well, that's fun now. You know, the book's out and I'm speaking. I'm trying to be an advocate and get rid of the stigma. You know, what people got to realize, it's not a weakness, mental health. It's a sickness,
right?
And it's a chemical imbalance with the brain, and it's no different if you're diabetic. What's that? It's a chemical imbalance of the pancreas.
Exactly.
So it's physical.
Exactly. Well, Clint, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. The book is from Triumph, and it's called A Matter of Inches, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night, Clint, to be with us. And I wish you nothing but the best, my friend.
All right. Thanks, Bill, and thanks, New York, Long Island.
And we hope to see you out here working on some horse's teeth real soon.
Yeah, maybe I'll sign some books, too.
We'd love to have you out here.
Okay.
Take care, Clint.
All right, thanks, Bill.
Clint Malarchik, folks. What I'd like to talk about before we go, Cy Berger, the father of modern day baseball cards, has died. I just wanted to let you folks know that he died of natural causes at the age of 91. Most famously devised a practice of signing Major League Baseball players a year after year to be able to use their name and image on cards in the annual sets. For more than three decades, Topps was paying players only $75 a year for that privilege, and most of the time that amount was applied to buying something from the company catalog. Berger's personal relationship with the stars in the beginning years made it easier to make them sign on the dotted line, though he did not sign St. Louis Cardinals slugger Stan Musial for the first 6 years. Berger was often seen at the side of Willie Mays, whom he considered among his closest friends. Topps was founded in 1938 as a chewing gum company. As the competition in the gum market exploded, Topps unveiled Bazooka, with the added value of comics to help sell the brand. That eventually led to putting gum in packs of baseball cards, and in 1952, Cy Berger arrived at the company to help make and produce the first set, which he designed at his kitchen table using cardboard and scissors. The pack of six cards were wrapped in wax and, of course, had a piece of bubble gum in it for the total cost of 5 cents. Despite having a Mickey Mantle rookie card in the set, sales were not good. Since they overproduced the second part of the set that year, Berger, for years, would try to unload the cards anywhere they could. Around 1959 or so, I went around to carnivals and offered them for a penny apiece, and it got so bad I offered them at 10 for a penny, Berger told Sports Collectors Digest in 2007. They would say, "We don't want them." In 1960, still saddled with a huge number of cards from the 1952 set, Berger put the remaining cards into three full garbage cans and commissioned a barge to dump the remaining inventory into the Atlantic Ocean. With kids putting the cards in the spokes of their bicycle, and years later, the parents of those who'd saved them throwing them in the shoeboxes full of cards, scarcity led to an era where the baseball card became an investment. After the T206 Honus Wagner card, the 1952 Topps Mantle is the most valuable card in the baseball card world. One of the 1952 Mantle cards sold at an auction last week for $2,608,664. Berger, who worked for Topps until 2002, was survived by his wife, Gloria, and his daughter, Maxine, his two sons, Glenn and Gary. Well, that'll do it. Thanks for joining me tonight. I'd like to thank my guests, Joe Barry, Carol, and Clint Malarchuk, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Raymond Moore and Brian White up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday evening, December 28th at 8 o'clock. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.